Okay, so can we start again? So today I will talk about how source texts are included in the corpus, which steps they have to go through before they can be a part of the Georgian National Corpus. But before I start with this, I will go back a bit to yesterday's topic and in some sense finish it, and also solve a puzzle we had yesterday, where I tried to disambiguate a sentence, and this wasn't done quite successfully. So in the meantime, I found out what went wrong, and this is quite an instructive example. So you remember the sentence we had was "Me da cemi da movedit," so I and my sister came. And here we had two problems. Me, which should be a nominative, was disambiguated as a dative. And da was, in both cases, disambiguated as a conjunction. So I have corrected one error, but not the other, because it's a bit tricky to do. But I would like to show you why this went wrong. The reason is, in one word, my rules were too naive. So I simplified the sentence a little bit. Me movedi. So this is a very simple sentence, and if the grammar can't cope with this, then I think it is not very useful. But as you can see now, the disambiguation is correct. Me is in the nominative, which is correct, since it is the argument, the subject argument of the verb, and in the verb you can see that we want a subject in the first person singular. So you see the verb has a subject, should be first person singular, and it should be nominative. So the rule that accomplishes this is found here. So we have a select rule, which selects the correct reading, and we can see what this rule says. It says, select the nominative singular of the a personal pronoun if there is a verb in the context which has a subject in the nominative and the subject is first person singular. And then we have a barrier which says don't go too far to the left or to the right. So this works fine. But when I go back to the sentence we had, I would like to ask you if you have an idea why it didn't work. Me da cemi da mo vedit. Why doesn't the same rule accomplish the same task in this example? Do you have an idea? I mean, we have a verb that wants a subject in the first plural this time, and here you see the point. There is no first plural, a personal pronoun. But what we have is a coordinated nominal phrase. Me da che mi da is a nominal phrase which acts like a first person plural. At least the verb licenses first person plural, and so me da che mi da acts like a first person plural. But my rule doesn't know about this. My rule wants, in this case, a first-person plural pronoun, which isn't here. We have a first-person singular pronoun, not a plural pronoun. So that's why why the grammar fails in this case. And the same reason was responsible for the wrong disambiguation of da in the second case. So we had a rule which said that if da is preceded by a possessive pronoun in the nominative, then don't choose the conjunctive reading. Or, I mean, the rule that chose the conjunction reading did so only if da wasn't preceded by a personal pronoun, by a possessive pronoun. Here it is, so this rule didn't fire. But at the end, I had a rule which said, remove all nouns in the nominative if they are not licensed by the verb. And here we have a verb which runs a first person argument. So this rule removed the nominative reading because it is not licensed by this verb. But if we look at the coordinated construction, the coordinated nominal phrase as a whole, then we see that it is licensed. So what I have to do, I have to add a new rule, and that's how it often goes when you write constraint grammar rules. You write a rule that is quite simple, maybe a bit naive, and then you see in the text, oh, here it makes a mistake, and then you have to improve your grammar.
What is she?
Yeah?
Why is not enough the part of speech of verb for is a referring of second da as a note? Very simple question. Why you need to compare the singularity or plurality of verb actions? Why is not enough the following of verb after da?
Excuse me, could you be a bit quiet? I didn't get that.
Excuse me?
I didn't understand you. Repeat it, please.
If I understand you correctly, you said that the singular first person of man and the plural first person of chamoleti is the why it doesn't work yesterday. And my question is, why is not enough to the part of speech verb after that as the rule for disambiguating of da as no and not conjunction? Do you have a case in Georgian in which the da before verb is conjunction?
Yeah, that would also be enough, I think, Da is...
Because you can, one cannot take firmly the rule that all das immediate before verb are no.
No, that doesn't work.
No,
that doesn't work. You can say, Jamedav Davlia.
Ah, right.
Very simple.
Okay, yes.
So, no, it's not that easy.
My question is maybe back.
Okay. So, that was this puzzle. And then I would like to show you which concrete tags we are using in the analyzer, so and how the readings are built up. So I told you yesterday that the readings of a verb form are built up of a lemma form and a set of features. I will now go through most of the features or many of them and explain you how they are used, or maybe the more interesting ones of them. What's this done? So, we start here. So, for nominals, it's quite easy. The lemma form of a nominal is the nominative form, and we also make a mark syncopation and apocope by setting the vowels in brackets. And the nominative ending is set off with a hyphen. So, you have, for example, gogo, where there is no nominative ending in New Georgian, this should be New Georgian, modern Georgian. Dzma has an R that is syncopated. Megobari also has an R that is syncopated and an E nominative ending. Pandara has both a syncopating R and an apocope at the end. So we have two brackets here. In Old Georgian, there is always a nominative ending. So we have mepei and mamai with a syncopating A and R. This is quite straightforward. It gets more complicated when we go to the verbs. The lemma form of a verb is a combination of the verbal noun and the verbal stem. So zers or uzerda all get the stem, the lemma form zera, that is the verbal noun, plus the stem zer. And also here the verbal noun is given as the nominative form with marking of syncopation and so on. Aris ikos is kopna, ar as the root, Daj Deba, Daj Jeki, Daj Doma, and this was wrong. I corrected it yesterday, but forgot to correct Z to, let me see, it should be Jde. Yes, okay. Participles, which are an intermediate thing between verbs and nouns, get both the nominal form plus the root. Zer, dajeri, jer, and so on. But here we have a problem, and I haven't solved it yet. So there are some verbs which don't have a verbal noun. I don't know what to do with them. For the time being, they have simply nothing or only a hyphen as the verbal noun. An alternative could be to use the perhaps first or third person future of the verb. I don't know if somebody has an idea what would be best, so we settled for the time being on the verbal noun. But I think there is no perfect solution. Then let us have a look at the features. So N is for noun. So Guino is analyzed as N plus nominative singular. So you have case and number, of course. And then we have subclasses for nouns, either proper noun or human. Those are the subclasses we are dealing with. Yeah, there are some more. So Tbilisi, for example, is coded as is analyzed as N proper plus some named entity tags. So toponym, place noun. Okay, I should have deleted place. Toponym is enough. In the nominative. Human is used for humans, of course, Gazi, and so on. Now you might ask, why do we include human? This is a semantic feature, not a syntactic feature, but it is quite useful when you do disambiguation to know that a noun is human. For example, subject of transitive verbs are often humans, so you can use that for disambiguation. It's useful in many other contexts. Additionally, we have qualifying nouns, so nouns that qualify a person. They are similar to titles, for example, professori. They are different from normal nouns because they have reduced forms like adjectives. Measurement nouns behave in the same way. And then we have temporal nouns. This, again, is a semantic feature, but it's useful because some temporal nouns can be used in the dative as adverbs or types of adverbs, and in this function they are not arguments of verbs, which again helps in disambiguation. We have abbreviations, as we saw yesterday, ke dot for kalaki, or an abbreviation for first name or last name also. Okay, here are more of those name features: anthroponym, first name, last name, toponym, organization like Gairo, foreign words, which are words in foreign orthography, maybe with a Georgian case ending. So in the description on the first page of the Georgian National Corpus, we have Volkswagenis, which is then analyzed as a foreign word, Volkswagen, but with Georgian morphology. So in the genitive, like this. Adjectives, didi, they might be quantify adjectives like chwela, then they get the quant. And then we have verbs. We saw already how the lemma looks like. Then we have quite many features that characterize the morphology of the verb readings. I will go through them a bit later. We have part for participle, present participle, past participle, future, and negative participle. Verbal nouns or masters, zera, seen that, and adverbs. And here again, we use subcategorize them as to adverb type: locative adverbs, temporal, manner adverbs, frequency, cause, interrogative, relative, negative, adverb, adverbs like the negation particle are, and so on. Then we have pronouns, personal, possessive, interrogative pronouns, indeterminative pronouns. And here we have two types, namely indet and es indet. You know there's a difference between virats and vinme. One is a specific indeterminate, vinme, and virats is an inspecific indeterminate, so we distinguish those. Then we have relative pronouns. You see the analysis here. Vins is analyzed as vin with a feature relative, but also with an enclitic ts, because this enclitic can be dropped in some relatives, so it's it is useful to have it also in the feature set. Reflexive, reciprocal. Then we have demonstratives. This is maybe a bit unusual to have demonstrative as an own category. S is demonstrative nominative, not specified for case because it's bound, modifying a noun. We have conjunctions and subordinating conjunctions or subjunctions like rom. Postpositions, shesacheb, and they are also marked for case, so which case they govern. I didn't include this here by mistake, which helps in disambiguation. Interjections, numerals, where we have cardinals and ordinals. They are divided into digits, so numbers. Alphabetical cardinals, like Sami, range cardinals, Sami Otri, and approximatives, Otriode, about four, repetitive, two times. We have also Romans, because they are used in, for example, bullet points or in chapter headings. And then we have letter numerals, which is used to tag Old Georgian letter numerals. So in Old Georgian, letters had a numerical value. For example, G is the number 23. G is 20 and G is 3. So they are then analyzed as a number. And then we have accordingly ordinal numbers. So we have case and number inflection for nominals. You have the normal, cases, nominative, ergative, dative, genitive, adverbial, instrumental, vocative, and additionally in Old Georgian, absolutive, directive, and beneficiary. What is it called? Beneficiary, I think, yeah. For the numbers, for the number, we distinguish between old and new plural. So the eb plural is the new plural, old plural is the one ending in n or ta. Chelt is cheli with old plural in the dative. And then, which is very prominent in Old Georgian, we have double and triple case ending. So we also double number and triple number. So we have, for example, something like gatsisaisasa, which is gatsi in the genitive with a double genitive agglutinated, and again a dative at the end. So in addition, we have also a marker for long forms. So you see katsisaisasa has an R at the end, which is the long form of the dative. For adjectives, we have reduced and for some nominals also truncated forms. So karg is a truncated form of gargi, which is used in bound adjectives. Then we have, mostly in Old Georgian, truncated case endings. For example, the adverbial in a instead of ad. So, for example, zed yosebisa, the Eusebissa is not the genitive as it looks like, but it is the adverbial, because it modifies Z, and so there we have suffix Aufnahme, as it is called in German, where we have a double adverbial which takes up the adverbial of the noun it modifies. Pardon?
Is there
a question?
Yes, I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's totally clear to everyone, but could you explain just in very simple words why there's double and triple marking?
In the cases when you have, for example, a genitive attribute that modifies a noun, then you have a genitive on the modifying noun, but you also repeat the case of the noun it modifies. So that's the double case that is added.
And how does it triple match?
It would work in the same way. You have two genitives attributes, one modifying the attribute that's modifying the first. Is that correct?
You can have theoretically any series of genitives.
Yeah.
Like something, the house of the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Georgia.
That's not all Georgian.
No. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, okay.
So in the house of the Minister of, and so on, and all this is built upon the form that the genitive suffix is copied, and then comes the locative dative.
But then in the end, it's just a repetition of the genitive suffix.
This is the only way to have more than two.
Mm-hmm.
One, the first ones must be genitives, and then comes something else.
Yeah, in Georgian, there in modern Georgian, there's only a triple case in some cases. But I don't think that there's only double case. Yeah, in old Georgian, I don't think there's more than three
have
case endings.
Have you seen anyone with more than two genitives?
Not more than two genitives. Yes, I did a corpus search and I didn't find more than that. So that's what is implemented. I don't think we need more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So for pronouns, there sometimes is an opposition between bound and free. Free pronouns, they are marked as bound and free. Personal pronouns get person marking and number marking, and possessive pronouns also get marking of the possessor as pos, first singular, and so on. Okay, I go. Now we have some interesting stuff, the verbs. Here we mark the verb class, active, medio-active, medio-passive, and passive, and also passive of state and causative. Medio-passive sometimes have inverted case syntax. This is also marked. It's also marked for perfect, I think, yes. Then you have all the tenses for modern Georgian and old Georgian, and they are sometimes different for modern Georgian and old Georgian, so I follow the traditional names for the cases. So we have optative in modern Georgian, but second conjunctive in old Georgian for the same tense, at least morphologically the same tense. So there are of those. In modern Georgian, aorists without preverb that normally have a preverb are marked as imperfective, which you can see here. Version is also marked, so we have subjective version, objective version, and locative version. So, which in Georgian you can mark a verb for. So a subjective version means that you do something for your own benefit. Objective version means that you do something for somebody else. Yeah, there's a question.
I want to know about meta cases. It's I say it right. It's then some letters move, and we have different.
Give me an example.
For example, modern Georgian form, but in old form there was a Khenava.
Yes.
And
yes. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. No, it's not marked. I mean, in the old. I mean, they're analyzed, but the metathesis is not marked in the lemma or somewhere else. So I don't consider this as a part of morphosyntactic analysis. Of course, when you go to Old Georgian, then we analyze the form without metathesis. For example, svla and slva. So the one is recognized in the modern analyzer, the other one is recognized in the Old Georgian analyzer.
I'm Georgian, and I know that it's this case, but when someone who doesn't know Georgian, Georgian language, reads this, he or she needs to know why is the difference between two words which have one meaning. I think it would be better if there were any remarks that where was this case and moved letters.
Yeah. In principle, you're right, but this, I think, would be a lot of work to implement, and it's not the first priority. So this is maybe a little bit something that
we make it.
That we can make later. So, yeah, we have had many discussions of that type with Georgian linguists who wanted to mark very many specific things that are more related to, let me say, diachronic linguistics or etymology, but we can't mark everything, so it's complex enough as it is. But thanks, it's maybe something we should consider. Okay, so we have this. I think I don't have time to go through all this. Let me say a bit about the verb actants. So we mark the verb for their arguments and actants. So there are a few verbs who have no arguments, like toves, it's snowing. Then we have verbs with a subject only, and then we have transitive verbs with a subject and direct object. So we have intransitives with a direct indirect object, and transitives with an additional indirect object, which in most cases is connected to the version marker, which says that that something is done for the benefit of somebody else, or that it's that the verb action happens on the surface of something, or with regard to the surface of something. Then we have person and number marking. We have seen this already in the examples I showed you in disambiguation. Subject person is marked, direct object person and number is marked, indirect object person and number is also marked. And then we have in Old Georgian also relicts of inclusive and exclusive and inclusive object marking. So forms that in modern Georgian are first person singular, where in pre-Old Georgian times exclusive, so not marked for a number, but either first person singular or first person plural exclusive, and the same for ge, which was not second person singular as it is now, but first person. Is this correct? Yes. So V was the inclusive form. Then there are many enclitics in Georgian. We also mark them, and we don't split off the enclitics when text is tokenized. This is done in some other paradigms, but not here. So they are just marked in the feature set. Indirect speech markers, in addition, And then we have bound postpositions, which are marked in a similar way as enclitics. And we have, at the end, punctuation. So this was a brief overview of the markers we are using. There are quite many, as you can see, but I think we should be as exact as possible in marking up the Georgian National Corpus, even if it needs a lot of disambiguation work. So now let me go to the main topic of today. I've already used half an hour, okay, but this is okay. So I would like to show you here how source texts that are to be included in the Georgian National Corpus are prepared and annotated in practice, which steps they go through, and there are many steps, before they can be included in the corpus. So as source texts, we have Old Georgian, Modern Georgian, no, this is Middle Georgian, and New Georgian, Modern Georgian texts, and we also have dialectal material, which we don't deal with at the moment. The Old and Middle Georgian material comes from the Titus corpus in Frankfurt. New Georgian material comes from different, quite diverse sources. There is going on transcription work here in Batumi, for example. They are transcribing a very interesting Muslim newspaper from the end of the 19th century, is that correct? Now beginning of the last century?
1920s,
okay, that's all right. Mm-hmm. Then there is an open source collection of texts where people have contributed digitized novels and poems to a site where we collected them from. They are included, as I will show you later. And then there is also OCR scanned material. There is digital bond material, so material that has been written on a computer, which we get, for example, many newspapers. We also have images and audio and video recordings. So we have facsimile images in the Titus corpus and audio video recordings in, for example, the dialect corpus, which will be a part of the GNC. So this is one end. The other end is the corpus. So, and a corpus is both text, but it's also a corpus engine, which enables you to view a corpus, to search in it, and to do statistics. But before the material goes into the corpus, it will be enriched with annotations. We are trying to keep the text structure, so for new material this means we keep headings, we keep paragraphs and so on, and even page numbers and line numbers. The material in Titus is much more richly annotated. There are text critical editions, and we also keep that information and try to make most out of it. And it will be multimedia. And last but not least, we add metadata, which is very important. We add information. Yeah, I'll tell you more about that in a minute. The steps that a text has to go through are the following. So first, we convert the source text, which comes in a multitude of formats, into one uniform format, which is XML TEI. Fortunately, we've heard a lot about TEI in the last lecture, so I don't have to go into much detail here. When that is done, the material is tokenized, and we get a new digital version of the text. Other pre-processing is done. Then we do morphosyntactic annotation, which I talked about yesterday. All this is then converted into a vertical file, which is the input format that the corpus engine needs in order to compile an index out of it. And the index is needed for search and display in the corpus tool. then we are where we want to be. The source formats, technically speaking, are for Titus Word Cruncher, which is, I would say, a legacy format, pre-XML and pre-SGML. For modern Georgian, we have plain text with a simple structural markup. And the target format is, as I said, XML, TI. It is very important to have a uniform text format because there will be a lot of text. There's a lot of text that we deal with, and if we had to adapt the routines for importing for every single format, then this would be a complicated task. So XML TI is the uniform format we are using. Back to Titus and Word Cruncher. Here you see how a Word Cruncher file looks like. It's not very readable. I got used to read it now, but it's not meant for human consumption, I would say. Less than XML. Then we have the modern texts where we use quite simple markup, which can be added manually, which can be put manually. And you see here, for example, this is a text by, I think it's Jeff Javadze, where you have, it's Jeff Javadze, where you have some header information, some meta information, then a title, which is abbreviated by cross T, and a line number. This is taken from a book. And then you have paragraphs which are represented by a line of hyphens, and then you have the text. This is much easier to read. So now you already know what TI is, the Text Encoding Initiative. It is something like a standard for representing text in XML in a digital format. There are quite detailed guidelines with recommendations how to mark up text semantically, or structurally and also semantically. It's especially well suited for text critical editions. We have in the Titus material coding of variants, so variants that come from different manuscripts are coded in a common text base. We have sometimes three annotation levels. The facsimile level, which is a detailed and faithful transcription of the text as it is in the handwriting. Then we have a diplomatic version where, for example, I think abbreviations are expanded. And then we have a normalized level where all this text critical stuff is taken out. So this is quite easy to code in TI XML because TI gives you all the elements you need to code that, and there are standards for it in TI. P5 is a newest format. We did some customizations for the GNC because we also want to do grammatical annotation, which isn't part of the standard TI package that you can easily generate on the web. But customizing TEI is quite simple there, or not simple, but it's doable using web tools on the web. Roma is the web tool we are using. Those guidelines are built up in a modular fashion, so you can pick what you want and what you need for your application. Then you customize them by adding or deleting elements from the style sheet. And at the end, you can generate a schema, which is a type of DTD for your project. A DTD or schema is a formal description of how your XML document can look like. So which elements are available, allowed, which elements can be included or contained in other elements, and which can't. So you can then run a validator on your text, and it will tell you where your document is, where there are mistakes in your document, semantic mistakes or mistakes in respect to your schema. This we run on all texts when they are prepared. A TI document is has two main structural units, a header where metadata about the text is coded, and then the body where the text itself is coded. Here, so a skeleton of a TI document looks like this. You have the normal XML preamble, then you have the top element, TI, which goes from the start to the end of the document. Inside there you have the TI header, then you have the body. So the body for some reason is also in a text element. The header contains detailed information about the text itself, about the original, the additions you have used for creating the digital version and the digital version itself. So we code date, place of origin, authorship, language variety, and so forth. There are also collection headers for text collections. Sometimes a text is taken from a whole book of similar texts. They get a header. So this whole book then gets a header. TI headers can be multilingual. So our corpus is multilingual in the sense that it is localized, so you can view it with Georgian explanations, with Georgian so with Georgian buttons in Georgian and so on, and in English and also in German. This is not finished yet, but you can do that. And it's necessary that the header also contains this information in those languages, or we haven't done it yet, but some header information is available in English and Georgian. Consistency is very important. Why? Yeah, consistency is always good, but it's very important here because we use the header information to for inclusion in the corpus. So we can search for information that is given in the header. And when, for example, authors are written in different variants and different documents, or more importantly, dates, then you will have difficulties searching in the corpus. So consistency is here very important. So specifically, I will go into the problem of date ranges or year ranges, 1900 to 1950, something like that. Here you see the a part of the header of one of the texts. This is Shushanik ist Zameba. Here you see how it then is presented in the corpus. So this is much more human readable than this, and you have all the information nicely formatted. Okay, dates. There are many ways of writing dates in Georgian, as in German and other languages, and specifically I mean years. So you can write 2014, which is perfect, 1939 to 1945, which is also perfect. But you also can write Meates Augune, so 10th century. This is not as useful because then you can't search for example, what would it be, 933, and get a hit for texts that are written in the 10th century if it's coded as Meates Augune, where you have Meates Augunes Otmotsiani Tzlebi, so the 80s of the 20th century, or another variant, Meates Augune, and so on. Here's a range. So what we are doing, we are normalizing those dates. All dates are given as either a number, if it's only 1 year, or as a range of numbers. We are using XX if the range, if there is a, this is a case of a, what is it called, century, yes. Oof. And decade has only one X at the end. But I came to the conclusion that it would might be better to code also them as 900 to 1000 or 1980 to 1990. It conveys the same information, but it looks much nicer in the formatted version of the header. But in those, it is easy to search. So for example, you can look for search for all documents written between 1700 and 1800 with an expression like origin date is included in the range 700 to 1800. So there is a special operator in the corpus system. In the same way you can, so this would be inclusion, you also can search for intersection. If you, for example, are searching for all documents that are possibly written between 1700 and 1800, then you can search for all ranges that intersect with the range you specify. And why that? It might happen that you have a document that you can't date exactly. You know that it must have been written between 1600 and 1750. In the first expression, you wouldn't get a hit, but because 1600 to 1750 is not included in 1700 to 1800. But if you take the intersection, then you get a hit here. And so this would be maybe more useful than the first one. Mm. The header fields that are now searchable in the corpus are the collection name. So if more than one text are aggregated in as a collection, the author, the translator, the origin, date of origin, genre, and language. And there will come more, I think, when we get a bit further with filling out the headers. So this is a complicated process, which is done here in Georgia. So people here fill out the headers for the documents we are putting into the corpus. And then we have the document body. There are several levels of text annotation. For digitized manuscripts, we have, as I said before, a facsimile level. We have diplomatic and normalized levels, and also critical apparatus and cross-references, which we want to make, into hyperlinks and similar things at the end. So we want to make them fully operative in the corpus. There's grammatical annotation, as you know, lemma, morpho, syntactic features, word frames, and all levels of annotation will be searchable. So here's an example of an original text in the TI XML encoding. You see that we have those tags from the TI, like head, line break with the line number and the type of line break. So here it is coded whether a line break comes from the edition or from a specific manuscript. Is there one? Yeah, here for example we have a page break which comes from a manuscript, and here is here the manuscript page is coded. The manuscript is the manuscript A, and it's page 353 rectum, is that correct? Yeah. Mm. In the next step, the text is tokenized. So we do tokenization, as I explained yesterday, and enclose every token in a word element. We also add unique identifiers to the word elements. So we number them in one text from one consecutively to the end, so we can refer to each word by an identifier. This is important when we do grammatical annotation. This makes grammatical annotation quite flexible. So the text can be edited afterwards, so errors can be corrected afterwards without disrupting the linking. So we can even add new words if something is missing, since the identifiers of the words that are already there are kept, also linking to other standoff markup will be kept, and we just get new words, which maybe have to get new standoff markup. So here's the same text with tokenization added. You see every word is now, and every, and also the punctuation is contained in the word element. Word ID W7 is Tzmidisa, and so on. Then grammatical annotation comes. In a previous version of the corpus, I added the grammatical annotation to the XML element. This is possible, so you can add grammatical annotation to the TI document and still have a valid TI document, but those TI documents get very, very big, and it's almost impossible to edit them afterwards if there's some mistake. So what we instead are doing is we do standoff morphosyntactic annotation. That is, the morphosyntactic annotation resides in a separate document and is linked to the main documents with to the main tokenized document by way of the identifiers. This we use a very simple format, not XML or RDF, but a tab-separated document. So a document with tab-separated fields, where the first column is the word, the next one is the lemma, one or more, and then the morphosyntactic syntactic features. So here's it how it looks like. So in the first column, you have the identifiers which link the morphosyntactic annotation to the words in the tokenized document. So we had W7, Tzmidisa. And in the next column, you have the lemma information, Tzmidai. And in the following column, you have the features. It's an adjective, genitive, singular, and a long form, and so on. You see additional bars here, and they are connected to the fact that we can have not fully disambiguated readings in the corpus. So, for example, here, where is it? Here, Sanat Relisa did get three analyses, so three readings. Sanat Reli, Natr, and this is a participle, but in the morphology, it is also coded as an adjective, because it's an adjective, and as a noun. So here, disambiguation hasn't been done fully, but nevertheless, we can include this in the corpus, and this will later be handled transparently when you search, so you don't have to know that this is not fully disambiguated. You can search as if it was fully disambiguated, and you get hits for any of those readings. So this is the standoff markup, which is quite close to the vertical file I will talk about in a minute. At the end, in the corpus application, when you, for example, look at the text in its entirety, you see how it is formatted. So here, for example, whitespace is added, and I told you yesterday that there is no whitespace information in the corpus, but whitespace can be reconstructed from the tokens themselves if some, by just using orthographic conventions that there is no whitespace before a comma, that there is no whitespace after a left quotation mark, and vice versa, and so on. And this works totally. This works very well. So we then have documents, or text documents, with where we distinguish the different coding steps by extensions. So XML is the complete text or text collection, where the reference to the TI header is done by external entities. We have the TXML element, which is the document body without tokenization. WXML is the tokenized document, and we have .tag, which is the standoff grammatical annotation. This is not very important. I would like to tell you a bit about how the TITUS documents are reformatted. This is quite challenging, I have to say. The TITUS format is Word Cruncher, and we want to go to XML. Word Cruncher is, as I said, a pre-XML format. It's not hierarchical. It's not fully hierarchical. It's only semi-hierarchical, and converting a semi-hierarchically encoded text into a hierarchically encoded text is a challenge. So you have to. It wasn't easy, and I have to do a lot of manual work for some of the texts. Word Cruncher is also more display oriented than XML, which is more, let's say, semantics oriented. Structural, it's structural markup. Mm-hmm. So the most main problems were that for different documents in TITUS, you have diverse high-level structures. So the Bible is coded differently from, for example, a transcribed handwriting, then fax and diplomatic normalized levels are coded in a special way. Then you have apparatus coding, which is not always exact. It's human readable, but it's not totally machine readable. So we have no solution yet. I have no solution yet how to make the apparatus coding fully functional in the corpus application. It works. Yeah, I think it will work at the end. And then we have line breaks inside words, or word breaks, which are coded in the following way. Let me see. So what we want to do at the end, we want to keep line breaks at the facsimile level. So in old Georgian manuscripts, when the scribe came to the end of the page, to the left, to the right end of the page, he continued on the next page, even if he was in the middle of the word and there is no hyphen, nothing. So this is then coded in the facsimile version. But in the diplomatic and in the normalized version, we want to have we want to have words as a unit. We don't want to split them at the end of the line. And in addition, we do tokenization. So all this has to be put into word elements. And these are somehow contradictory demands. I spent some time on finding a solution. And then I found one solution using TI reg, regularization, and ORIG, so original form elements. So what I did was that I put the part of the word that was on the next line into an ORIG element and repeated it in a regularization element together with the first part of the word. So like here's an example from the Graz Lectionary, one of the more difficult texts in TITUS. So each manuscript line here is transcribed at the facsimile and diplomatic level. You see here's the facsimile level. I changed I changed the markup a little bit to make it more readable. You see in the facsimile level, you have a word zina she, zina here, she here, which is split between those two lines. But in the diplomatic level, you see the parts of the words are joined, and there is a backslash marking that the word was split in the manuscript. So you have those two codings. And now when this is turned into XML, you see that I can't put a word element around Zina She here, and at the same time, Zina She here. So something has to be done here. Here is my first solution. This is the coding before tokenization. It replicates what we saw in the word cruncher version. You have Zina here and She here in the facsimile, and you have Zina She with the backslash in the diplomatic version. So now this and this has to go into one word element. How can this be done? Here's the first solution. As I said, I have Zina and a regularization element where I add the She, and in the diplomatic version I already have Zina She with the backslash, and this now neatly fits into a word element as you can see here. And then in order to be able to display the splitting of the word between the two lines, I have an additional auric element, which is not in a word, in an extra word element, because it's no new word. So this is only to help the display code to display it as a split when you view the facsimile version, and as a unit when you view the diplomatic version. But you can see this is quite complicated. And I found out that I don't want this. Fortunately, I've written the corpus engine myself, so I can tweak it to get the same effect with a much simpler coding. So here you see what I'm doing now. So I put a line break where it should be between the first part of the word, Zina, and the last part of the word, She, both in the facsimile and the diplomatic version. And I wrote a special code that treats those two variants when displaying. So this works now neatly with a much easier coding, fortunately. And search, in search you also can search for both. There again you have to do some tweaking, because you want to be able to search for the whole word, Zina She, which without a line break in between. So there will be an extra attribute in the corpus where the line break is removed. So now we are almost where we want to be at the corpus level. The main organization principle of corpus, at least in my system and in other similar systems like Corpus Workbench, which is widely used for coding traditional corpora and also other systems. The main organization principle is that you have a linear sequence of corpus positions with one token per position. What is different in my system is that there are structural elements like XML tags also count as tokens, but there are exceptions. So you have a linear sequence of corpus positions, and for every position you have the word, but also all the features that pertain to the word, so the lemma, the grammatical features, and also the metadata information, author, and so on. So let's take an example from Shushanik. Here's the input file with tokenization, and in addition you know that we have the standoff grammatical marking. This at the end looks, so here you have the vertical file. You see each line represents a corpus position, which I have, where you have the corpus position as a number. Then you have the word attribute, where, as I said, also XML attributes go. and of course the word itself. Then you have the lemma information. Of course, XML attributes don't have lemmata and features, but they also have metadata information. Here, only language is represented. You see that also the head has a language. This makes it possible to search for to restrict search for metadata also on XML elements. Here is an exception. You see, dedoplissai had a note behind it. So here you have the word dedoplissai. Right after it, there is a footnote, not filled out. And we don't want to have the footnote plus its content as positions in the corpus. So this is taken out into attribute which I call XML, which is used when displaying the corpus, but not when searching. I think this is a good compromise or a good solution for XML elements that would be in the way when you search in the corpus. Okay, I said every position is either a word or punctuation or an XML element. So what is a word? Yesterday I gave a definition. A word token is a string of characters that doesn't contain white space or punctuation and separated from other tokens by white space or punctuation. Here are examples. Shushanik, this is okay. It's a word, uncontroversial. Then you have Shemovin Mevida, which is a Tmesis form. I'll explain what this means. And then you have Eseigi, which is an adverb in Georgian, but it's not a word in the definition I gave you. There is a space in between. It's a word with spaces, as they are sometimes called, or a multi-word expression. In the corpus, they would be two corpus positions. And here we have a problem. We have two problems. The one is tmesis, and the multi-word expression is somehow the opposite problem. How can we treat with this? Tmesis, we can treat. So tmesis is an old Georgian verb form which contains incorporated a pronoun or an adverb between the pre-verb and the rest of the verb. So for example, shemo vin me vida means somebody came in. Somebody is what is incorporated in the middle, and came in is the rest, in and came. In Middle and Old Modern Georgian, you don't have those tmesis forms anymore, but in the older texts, the older Old Georgian texts, they are quite prominent. So an analysis would be that you, okay, so is it a word or is it two words? From different points of view, you would say it's a word or it's more than one word. So from the lemma and features point of view, I would say there are two words. One word is vinme, the one that is in between. The other word is shemosla, so shemovida. And they all have very distinct, they both have very distinct features. We can't somehow mix them up. So this should be treated as two lemma forms and two features. The order can't be defined, I would say, but on the word level, we have one word. So the solution is that we treat it as one word, code the tmesis form as one word, and two lemma forms in one position, and also two sets of features in one position. And this is possible because the corpus engine can treat multi-valued attributes, and also multi-valued set attributes. That is, Corpuscle is the corpus engine I've written. That is, we can code the lemma form as both the adverb form and the verb form, which in, I don't have the example here, but you can imagine how it looks like. You have the word in one position, then you have lemma as lemma form, or either vinme or Seamus Lyon-Wheat, and the features are also this set and this set. And when you search, you get a hit on Winmay and you get a hit on Seamus Lyon. So in this sense, this works perfectly well when searching in the corpus. You get a hit on the word when you search for it, you get a hit on the lemma when you search for it, on both lemmata, and you get a hit on any of the features you search for. So I think this is a satisfactory solution. There is one problem with it. Multivalued attributes are also used for coding ambiguous analyses. So if I had a word that had an ambiguous analysis as lemma Winmay and lemma Seamusla and features prone whom and so on and so forth and verb, then I would get exactly the same coding in the corpus. But I think that's something we can live with. I don't think there is another solution that is equally elegant and feasible, unless you come up with a better solution. So what is left is the opposite problem, words with spaces, multi-word expressions. So the word eseigi is an adverb, and we don't want to code ese and igi as separate words with separate features. We want to have them as one lemma and one word. And I must confess, I have no solution for it yet. I have some ideas, but I have to do some thinking before I find a solution. What's the time? Okay, this is the end of my slides. Maybe I should go into the corpus and show you some of the features of the corpus, how you can search in it, and maybe you have questions or... So, okay. So this is the interface of the Georgian National Corpus in inverted colors, unfortunately, so otherwise I wouldn't see it very well. And the corpora we have now, they are the Georgian dialect corpus, Marina Berita's dialect corpus, it's in here. Then you have the SSGG, which is the sociolinguistic survey, situation of present-day Georgia. I think that is something you compiled in Frankfurt. Yeah, and then we have a large Georgian, modern Georgian corpus, which I compiled some years ago and analyzed now with the newest analyzer. And we have some a pilot version of the Georgian National Corpus with all the grammatical annotation.
What is the GDCE? What does it mean?
GDC? Georgian Dialect Corpus.
Yeah, but what does it comprise?
Aha. I think Marina should answer that question. It contains field recordings of Georgian dialects, of diverse Georgian dialects, both with audio and video. They are not grammatically annotated yet, but they are working on it. So what will happen if I click here and search? Let me see. I can search for some word. Oops, sorry. So here I get some hits. Now I can, unfortunately I'm running this on my local machine. There's no audio and video. Maybe I have it, if the internet is working, I can go in to the server in Bergen. No. Oh yes, yeah, it's coming. Okay, GDC. Oh, okay, I see that it is that something is missing. It should be. It should also show you a video player.
This is SSG.
Pardon? SSG. Ah, okay. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, was the wrong one. No?
Yes.
What was it? We do have video in the SGG. Yes. Is that what you're saying? Okay. It's a bit slow. Here we have a video player. Now I should switch colors. Okay, I can try it. Okay, now we can go in one of the concordance lines and try to play it. It might happen that the connection is too slow. Don't know. But you get the picture. Now you would see a video recording of the text that's spoken here. But I'm afraid that the connection is too slow for this to work. Here it is. Yeah. Okay. So you can go in here by yourself and look at all those recordings. And nothing is anonymized. Is this a problem for us? Maybe not.
No.
So back to normal. Okay, so let me go to the small corpus we have compiled that already contains meta information. This is the one I call GNC. And here we can look at the list of texts. So not everything has meta information, only the old Georgian texts that are included here. You see that in the overview, you see both the language, Old Georgian, the domain, or and the original date range. So this is a collection, so I can click here and see all the documents that are in the collection. If the text is freely viewable, I can click here and go right into the text. So this is how it is formatted. Since this is a scholarly edition, a text critical edition, you see both line numbers and page numbers, line numbers, footnotes, and so on. And here we see that also names are coded, which is quite important. Let me go back to the interface. So, and I also would like to show you something very important, namely how manual disambiguation can be done in the corpus. This is something the Georgian collaborators will do here, and then I think I take a modern Georgian text, namely, where do we have? Okay, let me see. Ilya Chavchavadze, where is it? I can sort by language. Here is Ilya Chavchavadze. No, that was Tseretelli. Okay, I meant Tseretelli. Here we can, for example, take Otara and Krivi. Where is it? Where is it here? Bitte?
Take anyone.
I can take anyone, yeah. That's right.
Too many.
There are too many, yeah, to choose. Okay, I can take anyone. No. No, I can't take anyone because I don't have all of them on my machine. That's a problem. So let me see. I had it today, so it can't be very far. No, I can't. Oh yeah, it's Javadze, yeah, that's a problem, of course, what I wanted to take. So. Okay. Sorry. I'm sorry, I can't show it to you because it somehow doesn't work. Sorry, okay. But I think time is also finished now. I'll make a last try. Ah, I know why. Okay, I took the wrong corpus because we have a tagged corpus, and here, it's where I have to look. So, here it is. Okay, still one step. Okay, here we go. Now the text is being analyzed. Lexicon lookup takes some time, but not too much time. So those are 22 pages of text. Then I can go in edit mode where I see all the readings. And now disambiguation hasn't taken place yet. But when I click on disambiguate, the constraint prompt is running over the text. And we can see how it performs. So, yeah. Here you see. Most of it is disambiguated. Most of it also correctly, but not everything, of course. And here we have a case where there's more than one reading left. This is because the adverb isn't still coded correctly in the analyzer. But I go for the simple adverbial reading. So and then I can click here and manually choose one of the solutions. I can proceed here. Here we have gekitrat, which is a transitive verb. Can use this one. Choose this one. And here we have the case where. The form cannot be disambiguated from context alone because, it could. It's only one of them is non-reading. Okay, good. But here we have another problem with I have no solution for yet. Zwima is rain, and Zwima can both be a noun and a verbal noun. So it's a verbal noun, but it's also as a noun in the analyzer, so I could now arbitrarily choose one of them, but I think a more principled solution would be to only keep the verbal nouns and give it also a noun feature. So I think that would be the best solution. Here there's still a mistake in the analyzer, and so on. So you get a picture, you get an idea of how manual disambiguation can be done. And also, if you see that there's a wrong analysis, you can click here. There is a plus here, which means that there was more than one analysis originally. So you can click here, and you see all of them. And then you can go and choose the correct one. Or you can, if there are many features, or many readings, and you, for example, only know that it should be singular, then you can click on the singular and you get all the singular solutions, the singular readings, and so on. And here you see the rules that were used. You can go back to the grammar and fix it, and you know which rules fired in the analysis. Okay, I think we're done here.
Yes, so thank you. We still have some minutes for discussion. Paul will of course be here for some more days, so
yeah.
Maybe for very peculiar questions you can address him directly, and maybe we can also have a short session where you can show a bit more of this disaggregation process for those who will be involved. Is anybody here who will be doing some manual disaggregation for the corpus next time? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No,
there was another girl too.
Okay, so anyway, sure.
Yeah.
Take the opportunity and talk to Paul directly.
I still one remark. I have written up yesterday's lecture as a short paper, which I think you got distributed. But it's also online on the page of the GNC, and there I will put corrections and. Changes in the feature set will be reflected in the version that's on the GNC, so you can use it as a reference material for the feature set that we are using. So I'll try to keep it up to date.
Okay, so general.
Mm-hmm. Let me know, can we any difference between two words in this program between R and where?
In Georgian, R and where?
Negative context.
I see. Yeah, art and where, yeah, of course.
This remark that we are different from each other and which is this different? Can
here you see.
This?
Yeah, you see, so art is marked as a simple adverb. There is missing a neg, I don't know why. Okay, this reading should be correct. Now there's no context, that's why it got wrongly disambiguated. R gets advneg when it's in front of a verb. I put it in front of a verb, then the disambiguation will be correct. R. Movida. And ver movida. So there you see, the first one is advneg only, the second one is ad. Pardon?
We need context.
We need context to disambiguate, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, but here, I mean, you asked about the difference between ar and ver. And here you see the one gets only a neg feature, the other one gets a neg pot feature. So it's a potential negation. That's the feature, and also the lemma form is different. Hmm?